Hi, I'm Tedra Meyer, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited down a bit for clarity and brevity. Hope you like it. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Connor Sayers. In honor of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday today, we're listening back to a show from last year that looked at transracial adoption in Vermont. We looked specifically at highlighting the experiences of white parents who adopt black children. And we heard from guests about what it's like to raise black children when you don't have the lived experience of being black. Now, when we first aired the show, we got a lot of feedback about centering the voices of black adoptees in this conversation, which was surprising because when the show first aired, we did have that voice, Maddie Zeminski and her mother, TC, who live in Stowe. They come into the conversation later in the hour, so stay with us as we get to that part of the rebroadcast. Now, for those not familiar with the adoption process, it can be extremely lengthy and introspective. And, as part of the process, prospective parents are asked whether they would be open to adopting a child who is of a different race. And later in the hour, we'll hear from a white couple from Chittenden County who spent over a year thinking about that very question, before adopting two black children. But let's start with the first guest we heard from on that show when it first aired about a year ago. That's adoption specialist Kate Van Wagner, the options coordinator at Lund, a nonprofit adoption agency. I began by asking her where the adoption process begins.
Sure. So people who are thinking about growing their family through adoption, and we do private infant adoption at Lund, the first step with our agency is meeting with an agency to do what we call an informational meeting. That would probably be the first step with pretty much any entity that a family was going to contact to think about working through this process with. So we sit down these days over Zoom and we talk with an individual or a family who's thinking about this. And we just try to get a sense of where people are coming from, how they got to where they are in terms of thinking about adoption. Sometimes this is, you know, reaching out for an info meeting is the very, very first thing somebody's thinking about doing. Sometimes people have done a lot of deep thinking and talking and organizing themselves. And, you know, this is kind of the next step to formally moving forward. And then once they have an info meeting, you know, we talk about a lot of big topics at the info meeting, including transracial adoption, other things like openness in adoption, and just what that process is like in general to go through an adoption process for a family. We talk a lot about, you know, the perspective of birth parents and of adoptees and all of the mixed up, very intense life experiences that adoption entails, which is, you know, full of grief and loss in a lot of ways for everybody involved, and also can really be full of joy and belonging and family, right? That's what it's all about. So we really go there in those first meetings. And then if a family is ready to move on from there, they need to get what's called a home study evaluation. And that is a very rigorous assessment that licensed child placing agencies or other entities that are, you know, legally able to do those evaluations put together. And that involves a bunch of interviews with the individual or couple. It involves a home visit. We talk to people's doctors. We look at their taxes. We do background checks. We really get in there. And there's a lot of logistical stuff that goes with the home study. And then, you know, there's also a lot of deeper, I call them the juicier discussions come along in that home study.
Let's talk about some of those juicier discussions. Now, I understand that at Lund, there is a questionnaire or the series of questions that you ask potential parents. Can you just give us an example of some of those like meatier questions that you're going through and the discussions that you're having with families?
Sure. So I'll talk about the transracial adoption question since that's what we're here to talk about
today. Yeah.
You know, we really ask people to think about, we want to hear from them, you know, if they are, if it's a white person or a white couple who are even starting to think about or really excited about the potential of transracial adoption, we are asking them to think about, hey, what is your family and your community and the groups of people that you interact with on a day-to-day and year-to-year basis, what do those groups of people look like? What does your town look like? You know, what kind of representation of different races is in the community you live in? what kind of work have you done on your own white identity and in dismantling racism within yourself? And, you know, what is your understanding of how racism impacts BIPOC folks these days? And, you know, kind of where are you in the thinking about that? We ask people to really consider kind of doing that. I think of it both as the digging down into themselves, looking at with honesty and vulnerability and courage, looking at their families and communities and friends groups through the lens of considering this, becoming a multiracial family. And then also thinking about taking the perspective of if they were to adopt a child of color, what might the experience of that child be like living in their family? And we really try to walk through families with looking at that in pretty detailed ways, both in the, you know, kind of basic, what do things look like? Is your child going to be able to have a Black medical provider? Is there going to be someone to do their hair that lives in your community? What's their classroom going to look like? But also thinking about the real impacts of, you know, how might you deal with racism as a family? And it's not a question of if that's going to come up. It's a question of when and how. And we really want to prepare families to be, you know, joyfully in family with each other and to be being as wonderful parents as they can to their child of color.
And these conversations of preparedness, I understand are new, or like a part of a new wave that didn't always happen. How have these conversations, like, how have they changed? Like, where did we start from? And then where are we now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I started at Lund about 10 years ago, and we were definitely talking with families about transracial adoption and asking some of these questions. And as the years have gone on, we have just heard more and more from, gosh, such brilliant and generous leaders in this field who are transracial adoptees themselves. I think of people like April Dinwiddie, who is a Black adoptee raised by white parents and has a podcast and has come to train us in Vermont as adoption professionals and train a lot of our families. I think of people like Angela Tucker and Rebecca Carroll. So, you know, these are people who are sharing their experiences of growing up in an era when white people who were adopting children of color were told, and it was kind of, you know, in the cultural consciousness then too, colorblind. You know, I grew up, I'm what, 38. I grew up in elementary school, like it's all the same. It doesn't matter, right? And, you know, I think hopefully as a society, we're moving past that and realizing the harm that that can cause and that, you know, this does matter. Racism does exist. Difference can be challenging and celebrated. And, you know, what we're doing now is asking parents to just really think about that in ways. And we're not automatically saying, if you're interested in this or excited about it, sure, we'll approve you to adopt transracially. We are really asking people to sit with this and get it, you know, as much as is possible in this process and just get themselves moving along their journey of racial justice themselves. And I would say that's different.
I don't want to interrupt. Go ahead.
One thing that's changed that's interesting to me in the past couple of years is I've heard from more families coming in for that very initial contact that, you know, some, you know, white couples coming in and saying, you know, we have thought so deeply about this. We've been reading, we've been watching, we've been talking to people, we've been, you know, seeking people out. We're just, you know, sponging it all in. And we're realizing, you know, we would love to commit to this and do what it takes to do this as right as a human can do. And we don't think we can ethically do this where we live. They might live in a super, you know, rural, isolated, extremely white town. And, you know, some of what we're hearing from adult transracially adopted people is, you know, that is a big challenge as a person of color. And so it's interesting to me just seeing this shift, and people seem to be coming to the table initially with some more complex thoughts about this and some more awareness of the realities of what it's like to grow up in a family where you don't share the racial identity of your parents and family, and also that it's really hard in your community to find, you know, people to connect with who share the same race as you.
And I understand that as you're having these conversations, people are having these conversations earlier, so they already have a sense of what they as a family and what their community can put up with. Can you, or will tolerate, I guess I should say, appropriately. Can you tell us about some of the people who choose not to adopt outside of their race and what those conversations and what you're hearing from them?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, people who have come to that decision in the more recent years, I think a lot of people, again, are thinking in really deep ways about the experience of the child, the adoptee who then will grow up into an adult, right, in that community. And, you know, I'm hearing from people who are just saying, you know, we can't ethically do this because we see how isolating of an experience this would be. And we have just heard from so many people who've had these kinds of experiences, the harm that that has caused. That said, there are people who live in very overwhelmingly white places in Vermont who feel that they can move forward with that commitment. And they have really concrete, what we ask is for them to have really concrete, not just plans, really concrete actions that they're taking as they even think about growing their family transracially, right? We're asking them to do that now. How are they going to build community now? How are they going to start working for racial justice now if they haven't already? And are they going to develop, and can they now develop meaningful relationships with other people of color, knowing that if they are to be parenting a child of color, that's what their child is going to need?
Yes, and we're hearing from our listeners who have told us just how hard it is. One listener emails us and says, my wife and I are months away from adopting our mixed race child after fostering for 2 years. At 6 years old, we've already had a child tell ours, quote, Black people aren't allowed at summer camp. I wish we didn't have to have the difficult conversations about race so young, but I'm learning that Black Americans have always had to have those conversations with their kids from a young age, just to keep them safe. We will do our best to teach them about their heritage, find people and activities to keep them connected to their heritage, and work on bettering ourselves to be advocates for our child. I mean, you hear this, and it's heartbreaking, but this is the reality. What resources are available for people who are considering, or people who adopted kids outside of their race and are kind of struggling?
Yeah, I mean, there's some great organizing, I think, both maybe through the consortium and kind of grassroots by parents. And when I say the consortium, I mean the Vermont Consortium for Adoption and Guardianship. I hope I've gotten that title right. But that's a group that is statewide in Vermont that consists of all the different people involved with adoption across the state. And there are several support groups and kind of even play groups sometimes for transracial families, multiracial families. So I think that's always a good resource to connect with, I guess you can call them peers, you know, people who are going through these same experiences, which of course is important both for the parents and the children in those groups. So those have popped up in different parts of the state over the years. And of course, you know, connecting with the agency you're working with or the entity, you know, like Lund, to get connected with other families in the community who might be willing to, you know, meet up and share experiences and resources. And I think, like I spoke to earlier, there is such a deep well of work that is coming out, again, from people who have grown up in families through transracial adoption, who are sharing what that was like, both things that went really well and things that were really challenging and they wish their parents had known before they got into this path. So I am always pointing to people to, again, hearing from adoptee voice is crucial. And I think just in general also, you know, we have amazing organizations and movements and grassroots groups that in the state are organizing for racial justice and doing anti-racism work. And I think that can be an equally important place to connect and dig in.
I'm Connor Cyrus, and you're listening to Vermont Edition. This hour, we're listening back to a show from last year about the lived experiences of white Vermonters who choose to adopt Black children and the challenges that transracial families face. We thought that Martin Luther King Jr. holiday would be a good time to give this particular episode a listen and understand some of the challenges around race in this country, and in this case, what families still face. Stay with us later in the hour when we hear the voice that many listeners said they wanted front and center in this discussion. We'll be hearing from a Black woman and her white mother discussing growing up in a transracial family in Stowe. But first, we'll rejoin the conversation with Lund Options Coordinator Kate Van Wagner. And in a moment, you'll hear from a couple in Chittenden County who adopted two Black children. But first, we take some calls, starting with Chris, who called from Londonderry.
All right, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to give notice that there are a lot of single white parents that are raising biracial kids that are going through the same struggles that transracial adoptee families are going through. And I think it'd be really important and really crucial to widen that focal point to just show that they're going through the same struggles too, because there are a lot of, you know, BIPOC children that are being raised by single white parents that like I said, are going through the same thing. So,
Chris, I want to say thank you for that call. And if you don't mind me asking, like, how do you identify?
I am biracial, and I was raised by a single white mother. So,
We're losing you, Chris, but I just want to say thank you so much for that call. And it does just go to show that these experiences that we're talking about today go beyond just Black adoption, and there's so many other ways we can tackle this issue. But today, we are going to focus on white parents who are adopting Black children, but there is more of the conversation to be had. And listeners, as I mentioned, later in the show, we are going to hear from a Black Stowe High School student who was adopted by white parents. She's going to share her experiences and what she thinks you need to know about growing up Black with white parents in Vermont. But now I want to welcome Jess and Ben Edgerly Walsh, Chittenden County couple who adopted two Black children. Ben and Jess, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks so much for having us.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, Ben, I'm going to start with you. Can you just tell us, you have two children. Can you give us their ages and when you adopted them?
Yeah, we have a son who is six and a daughter who's three. And we adopted them both when they were infants, newborns. And we started working with Lund about a decade ago before adopting our son.
And Jess, tell us about the journey to adoption. What led you to adopt Black children?
Well, as Kate was describing, we got the massive questionnaire and started working through it. And much of it we were able to tackle in a few weeks' time. Questions about discipline and education and parenting techniques on a variety of fronts. The question about would we be open to adopting children of a different race? We had our gut reaction, of course, was like, of course, we'd accept any child into our family. And then we took a minute and thought about that and recognized that was a much more complex question. And so I think it's very similar to what Kate was describing. She was hearing from folks engaging them early in the adoption process, started talking to our friends of color and reading the stories of adoptees, reading psychologists who've spent time studying and working with adoptive families, and just listening in any way we could to Black folks' experience and trying to understand if we were in a place to parent into that space in a healthy and whole way. Part of what we learned is that while Black adults adopt at a higher rate than white adults do, there's still, as we know from this conversation, is the need for transracial families. And so we felt like we could do this as well as another white family could. But our friends of color were very clear on a couple of points, which is, please move to a community in which kids can see themselves, where they won't be the only, in the classroom, and think about how you're spending time outside of the state and what you're teaching your kids about the rest of the world. So a few deliberate decisions we made as we said yes to adopting children of color was making a move from central Vermont to the greater Burlington area. So we live in Winooski now, and kind of committing our vacation family time to hubs of Black culture. So we've taken our family to Philly and Baltimore. So there are other commitments, but just some clear ones we made to make our family make this work as parents.
Now, as parents, y'all clearly did a lot of research and had a lot of conversations. But even with all that prep, have you been surprised at some of the at how people have responded to your children? I'll let either one of y'all take that.
Sure. I guess I don't think it's interesting. It's not sort of intellectually surprised, but certainly when something that you've read about, and as a white person, as you said in your introduction, we just don't have the lived experience. I was not a Black child when I was growing up. Obviously, seeing things play out in real time makes it just much more real than it's, something that you're hearing in a conversation or, a news item or reading about in a book. There are little things that just happen all the time. And, you know, we can sort of deal with them, but you do sort of wonder how they accumulate with your children. I was, you know, walking my son into school the other day, and another kid a few years older than him, I think, needed to call his mom and asked me, you know, can I borrow your cell phone? And of course I said yes. And in sort of handing over my cell phone for a moment, he said, "Oh, are you his dad?" And, you know, of course we've had conversations around those sorts of questions with our children, especially our older child. But, you know, as that just sort of happens more and more, and more for a Black child adopted by white parents than a white child adopted by white parents, because it is very visible physically. We just, you know, have our children in these moments more often. And I think it's just something that we have to grapple with on a very sort of day-to-day standpoint, just like the kind of racism, implicit and explicit bias that, you know, a fully African-American family would deal with.
Jess, do you remember the first time, or like one of the first instances where you were caught off guard by a situation where somebody responded to your kid inappropriately?
Sure. Yep, vividly. I was in a building with an elevator, so probably in Burlington somewhere. And Gabriel, I think, was 3. And this was the first time somebody sort of helped themselves to his hair. So Gabriel has beautiful, long, black coils. And we've always kind of grown the top out long because it's just gorgeous. And so, you know, me and my little 3-year-old head into the elevator. Middle-aged white woman, just total stranger, sinks her hand into his hair. And I knew this was going to happen at some point. I did not know it was going to happen today. And sort of was rocked back on my heels, kind of scooched Gabriel over to the other side of me and took a deep breath and had that little back and forth you have about which button you're going to press or which floor in the elevator. And we both descended to the lobby, and I needed those few floors of time to kind of, you know, take a minute and pull myself together. Decided that I definitely needed to address it in the moment. This woman needed to know that was inappropriate, but also my kid needed to know this was inappropriate. Even as a 3-year-old, that he shouldn't, that this was not okay for an adult and authority figure in his life to do. And so decided I didn't need to go too deeply into historical context about white people touching or inspecting Black bodies, but I was going to keep this really simple. And when we kind of like ding hit that lobby floor, I just explained to her that it was inappropriate to touch another person, particularly a Black person. And she, of course, kind of apologized quickly and we were off. It wasn't surprising again, but as a white person, had never experienced that, nor had you know, watched my parent deal with that. And so needed a minute to collect myself. And now I'm very prepared. And now we're right on the money when that happens.
It's always that gut reaction, right? When something happens, you're just like, I have no idea how to respond to this. And you try to figure out, am I going to yell? Am I just going to ignore it? And so that's something that I think a lot of Black people and BIPOC deal with on the regular with when it comes to education. You said you feel more prepared now as parents. Does it get easier having those conversations with white people now that you've been through this a couple times and for several years now?
You certainly, I mean, you get sort of more repetitions on it. And as with anything, I don't know if practice makes perfect, but it certainly makes it more comfortable and more, I don't know, routine is too strong, but certainly kind of in that direction. I will say sort of on the flip side of, you know, speaking with our children, certainly as they've grown up, we've done that more and more as well. You know, those conversations, I don't think get easier. They just get more complicated. You sort of, there's just more layers and more layers and more layers, and there will be their entire life. And so our conversations with them are not getting simpler, even if we're getting more practice. They're just getting longer and more in depth.
Now, Ben, I'm going to start with you on this question. What has been fun to learn about either through raising your kids or through Black culture that maybe you weren't ready for, but it's like super fun now?
I think, you know, Jess mentioned the ways in which we have change, you know, where we might travel, where we might go, what we might spend time on. That has been, you know, really wonderful, and obviously less so over the last couple of years with the pandemic, but, you know, sort of dipping our toes in those cultural waters and, you know, just mentioned really wonderful trips we've had to Philadelphia and Baltimore, and, you know, we're really looking forward to doing quite a lot more of that. And, you know, we've seen, as our children are still very young, sort of little bits of how they are excited about learning about culture, that, you know, it's coming from people whose skin looks like theirs, just to put it very bluntly. And I'm really looking forward to sort of continuing that journey with them as they grow up through their childhood and into adulthood, and you know, being excited about those things with them is really just wonderful.
Let's go to Chinon in Brattleboro. Chinon, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me. Yes, it's Chinon. You pronounced it perfectly the second time.
Okay, good. I got there.
Long time listener and first time caller. I just want to first off say I was raised in a biracial family here in Vermont, and I had a beautiful experience. But I did call because I wanted to recommend a book for any families that are raising a Black adoptee child. It's by the author Rebecca Carroll, and it's called Surviving the White Gaze. And she grew up in rural New Hampshire, so it's very similar to what we have here in Vermont. And she has been, the hardcover just, I think, recently came out. And she was also just featured on, like, The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. And she is very outspoken about her experiences. And I could not recommend the book enough. She's a wonderful, wonderful author. So for parents out there who might be going through something, or for children who've gone through something similar.
Thank you so much for that call, and thank you so much for letting our listeners know about that book. Jess, I want to ask you, how is talking to other parents when they see that you have a Black child or Black children? How do those conversations go, and what do they look like? Because I think for a lot of BIPOC listening, we're not privy to what people and how people talk about us behind our backs, but you kind of have a special window into that world. So can you just give us a little glimpse?
Sure. I mean, as any parent knows, I think your children end up setting, especially when they're young, your social calendar maybe more than you do, in that you spend a lot of time with their friends' parents. And, you know, for the most part, the conversations are exactly what you'd expect in terms of getting to know a new person and building a friendship. But as a parent of a Black kiddo and a parent in a transracial family where we, you know, stand out and the differences are just so clear, as Ben was saying earlier, I definitely feel the need to kind of lean in and open some doors to conversation about both adoption and race. And so at some point, you know, when we're hanging out in the playground, I'll ask something like, you know, has Susie Q asked any questions about our family? I mean, I'm sure she knows that we don't match. And sometimes I'll get a very thoughtful response where, yes, parents have chatted with their kids about adoption and race and have opened those doors of conversation. And I'd say more often than not, they have not. And the answer is we don't talk about differences. We just want them to be friends. And so, okay. It's another moment where you sort of rock back on your heels and you take a minute and figure out where you want to begin. But yeah, I recognize that as a white person, I have, you know, spaces and a voice of advocacy to really kind of implore especially the parents who are parenting my kids' friends to say, hey, I really need you to start opening conversations about this now so that, you know, your kid doesn't feel like adoption is something we can't talk about or some kind of secret. And more so, so that they start to have kind of open eyes and this can be a really whole friendship. And our kids aren't the ones having to explain everything to them. but they can be really allies and like I said, whole friends to our kids. So yeah. So, I think, you know, white people don't have any, most white people, myself included, we did not, I have no lived experience of talking about race growing up. And so we don't have an example. We don't have a comfort level. But I get to invite folks into that conversation, as awkward as it is to start, which is great. And I'm grateful for so many parents who have leaned in, even sort of through that initial moment, and engaged around it.
And Ben, how are you talking? I mean, your kids are very young. They're 3 and 6. How are you talking to them about race and bringing that up? As we heard an email earlier that, you know, a 6-year-old was told that Black people aren't allowed at summer camp.
Yeah, obviously it's tricky. We have not run into anything that overtly bigoted. I guess I would say there are some really important ways that it is very similar, and really important ways that it is very different than talking about other hard topics that I think a lot of grownups see sort of as conversations for adults to have, right? Conversations about war or democracy or global warming, as your listeners were hearing before Vermont Edition started. With any of these big topics that have layer upon layer of complexity, talking to a kid, as any parent, you have to sort of interpret or translate into language that is accessible for a child of whatever age you're talking to, and sort of lands with them in a productive way, without being just scary or sad. Right? In a way that actually can help them process what they're experiencing day to day. So there are a lot of ways in which talking to a child about race is similar to that. With our children, obviously there are a couple of really critical ways in which it is different than those other hard conversations. The most obvious one being the one we've talked about already. They have brown skin. They experience this day to day. We do not have some call it a luxury. I think that's inappropriate. It's actually more of a pitfall. The luxury of not talking to our kids about race, right? There's just no way we can do that and do right by them. I think many white parents sort of feel like that's okay to do with their white children, or maybe even good, because colorblind is something that, you know, has been attributed value in our society. That's not a path we have open to us. And I know it's been mentioned, but I certainly hope it's a path fewer and fewer white parents are seeing as an okay thing with their children, because it's not doing them a service, and it's certainly not doing our kids who are talking to your kids a service either. The other way, obviously, that it's very different is we don't have that sort of lived experience. And so I would imagine, this is not my experience, but I would imagine if, you're an African-American parent with Black children and you grew up as a Black child in America and you've experienced this growing up and you've seen your parents talk to you, talk to their friends and family and white people who've approached you about racism, you've absorbed a lot through your life. We have not. And so we have to spend the time to talk to friends, to read about, to really try our best to understand how to have those conversations and how to sort of do that translation for our children.
That was Chittenden County couple Ben and Jess Edgerly Walsh sharing their family story of transracial adoption. Today, we're listening back to a show from March of this year discussing transracial adoption with guest Kate Van Wagner, the options coordinator with the nonprofit adoption organization Lund. In the final portion of the show, we'll hear from two women from Stowe, a young Black woman named Maddie Zeminski and her adoptive white mother, TC. I welcomed them to the show by asking Maddie to share what it's like growing up Black in a white family, especially in a majority white state like Vermont.
Okay, so I was brought up right in the middle of Stowe with my two parents, and for the majority of my life, up until my teen years, I was dealing with a lot of confusion, I think. confusion mainly just being because I didn't realize that I was different, but at the same time I did, and I couldn't really put a term to that. And I think that led me to feel a lot of emotions that I didn't know how to place. And while it was something that I wanted to figure out with my parents, it was an experience that we were all figuring out together, because this was something that was new for all of us. My family is very, very white. And this experience, having me in this family and having me grow up and learn more about myself, was definitely something that we all had to incorporate ourselves into and work on. So as I was growing up, there was things that I was learning that we all found ourselves learning at the same time, that came with me learning how to do my hair, or learning why my skin looked different, or learning why the stereotypes were placed on me that weren't placed on other kids my age. And I definitely was dealing with that kind of identity crisis as I aged, but it was also something that my whole family was kind of brought into, because we were all learning at the same time.
We had talked yesterday some about the missteps that maybe your parents took in the lack of maybe acknowledgement of your Blackness. How do you think that that's shaped who you are today?
I think that that's definitely led me to do a lot of activism and to reach out to the youth in my community, because from my experiences, it took us a long time to learn what we personally needed to change as a family to figure out what was going to best benefit myself. And after learning what experiences weren't working, that definitely made me realize that there were so many people in my community and outside of my community that were definitely feeling the same things and going through the same things. And I didn't want to be the person that would just stand by and let it happen. And I think that shaped me to definitely just get more involved in my school community. I got really into like the racial equity group in my school. I formed that group with a few people there, and it's been going pretty strong for 2 years. I definitely just wanted to reach out more. It shaped me just to want to expand my reach to more people. And I think that was the biggest thing that I saw change in myself from when I was younger.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I presume that at some point growing up, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, you thought to yourself, my life would be so different if I just had Black parents who understood what I was going through. If you had those thoughts, what was the conversation that you had with yourself of, you know, wanting more people that looked like you, especially in your family?
I think I realized at some point that I could get as much sympathy as was necessary, but I couldn't get empathy because my parents just couldn't empathize with the things that I was experiencing. And when I eventually realized that, and I realized that when I was having these situations and altercations at school or in public with people that I didn't know who would just find it necessary to say things or to use slurs, I would come home and it would be a difficult conversation for everyone because they just couldn't relate to that. They could tell me how sorry they were that it was happening, and they could tell me that they just wished it could get better, but there was nothing else they could do for me. So I realized at some point that it was a very lonely thing to be doing by yourself when there's no one who can tell you what you can do for yourself. And that was a big point in my life that really changed how I had to view things.
TC, you are Maddie's mother. You are white and you adopted. Maddie, when you hear this, what goes through your mind?
Yeah, well, actually what you're listening to Maddie describe is just the perfect storm of having parents who were advised 18 years ago when we began, or actually it was more like 22 years ago. Maddie's 18 now, but about 22 years ago when we began the process to be colorblind. And once you kind of grab onto that notion, you take away the need and the importance for representation, right? And for truly diving into acknowledging the trauma that being colorblind is going to present. And so that's basically what you're hearing. I'm not surprised by what Maddie's saying. I've heard it before, and it's we're working through this as a family now. But had we kind of been I don't want to give the notion that I'm looking back with regrets, or that our story is a sad one, but certainly there are a lot of things that we could have done differently had we not been so caught up in this notion that she was just one of us, and we were just going to carry on as though her skin color didn't matter, because it does, and it did, and it does.
Maddie, what advice do you have for people for parents specifically, who are thinking about adopting children outside of their race?
I would say Black and brown children and adults, they face stereotypes assumed of them throughout their entire lives. So when you as an adopt child find yourself surrounded by this white majority and the influences of what is like stereotypically a white lifestyle, you can find yourself stuck between the stereotypes of like two demographics. And in my experience, that led me to feeling too white to be Black, yet too Black to be white. And a child, and any child, often reflects the mannerisms and the personality and the style and many overall aspects of their parents. And when you have a Black or brown child who reflects their white parents, there will be ignorant people who find it confusing, while that has less to do with the family and more to do with the misconceptions surrounding what gives a Black and brown person the credibility to adopt a label for themselves. I would say learning to experience things for both the parents and the child together, I would say that's one of the most important things you can do. So one thing that, while we didn't do it perfectly, I'm still glad that we did it somewhat right. I'd say, for example, don't put the comb in the kid's hand and let them figure out how to do their hair themselves. Figure out how to do that together, because even if it's something that you're both learning together and you don't know how to do it, it's better for the kid to look on their parents, since they look up to their parent as that figure that they're going to want to grow up towards and grow up to be, to understand that it's something that you can all work on together. So even if you don't have the same hair or the same skin, you can still work on the problems together instead of putting it on the back of the kid. Because as you grow up, there's a lot of things that are put on the back of Black and brown people and said that it's their issue to deal with, when it just adds more to their plate. And taking that weight off and just doing it together is one of the best things you can do.
Maddie, I just want to say that I don't think you're alone, because I can speak for myself when saying that it's confusing sometimes being Black when you are not the representation that white people expect of you. And so I hear you when you say that you were too white for the Black kids, but too Black for the white kids, because there's an awkward space that some of us, specifically Black people, but I think all BIPOC, end up in, this like no man's land of you just don't fit in anywhere because you are not what people expect of you. Maddie, do you mind just sharing? I know we talked yesterday, and I just want our listeners to hear the story about what happened in school, specifically with the lice checks.
Okay. So when I was younger, I went to the same private school for 10 years. And throughout that time, we would have not too frequent, but occasional lice checks in school. And they would have people come in, volunteers, to do the lice checks, and they take the entire class out at once, and then we'd all get it done and we'd all go back to class. And as one of the only kids of color in my school, I started to figure out very quickly that my hair was just posing an issue for people when it shouldn't have been. There could have been better ways to handle that. When people would try and check my hair, they would just push me away, and they'd say to my parents, like, her hair is just too difficult to deal with. Like, it just doesn't work, or it's too curly, or it's too matted. And matted wasn't even the right term, because my hair was just curly, and it just wasn't like all the white students with their straight hair or their wavy hair. And that really frustrated me. I cried. They would pull at my hair and they would break it. They'd break it off and they'd tear it out. And I remember very vividly this one experience with this, where this woman was doing a lice check on me. And I think she took close to an hour, when it took other kids maybe like a minute. She took me out of class for an hour, and I missed all of that time. And when I went back, all of my hair was like damaged and broken, and it was really frizzy, and the kids were making fun of my hair then because it was just all puffed out, and I was really embarrassed. And things like that, we began to realize, were posing an issue towards me and my family.
Maddie, we have about 30 seconds left with you, and I just want to—I want to end on a—I want to end on a happy note. What's bringing you joy these days?
Bringing me joy is I'm painting a lot. I'm heading to college soon to be an art student, and I paint a lot of Afrocentric art. I paint a lot of Black and Brown people, Indigenous peoples, and my most recent works are up in River Arts currently, where I did something for the Lamoille Art and Justice Project, and I painted a bunch of BIPOC narrators who worked on an oral history project, and that was super fun.
We're going to have to leave it there. We have T.C. Zeminski, who is Maddie's mother. T.C., thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us as a part of this super important conversation.
Absolutely. Maddie, I just want to say thank you so much for being so open and vulnerable and sharing your story with our listeners. I really appreciate it. I think they learned a lot from you. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
That was TC and Maddie Zeminski of Stowe, sharing their lived experience as a transracial family from a conversation first aired on Vermont Edition in March of last year. We also heard from Kate Van Wagner, options coordinator with the nonprofit adoption organization Lund.